James Patrick Kelly, Part 3. Chapter 9. Chapter 9 begins with a quote from Wild Apples. "For when man migrates, he carries with him not only his birds, quadrupeds, insects, vegetables, and his very sward, but his orchard also." Capability Roger Leung loved apples. He was fond of the other poems as well, especially Pears and Quince. Stone fruits he didn't much care for, although he tolerated sour cherries in memory of Jiga's pies. But apples were Cape's favorite, the ancient fruit of the home world. He claimed that apples graced the tables of all Earth's great civilizations, Roman, Islamic, American, and Dolomist. Some people in Littleton thought that Spur's father loved his apple trees more than he loved his family. Probably Spur's mother, Lucy Bliss Leung, had been one of these. Probably that was why she left him when Spur was 3, first to move to Hart's Wall, and then clear across the continent to Providence. Spur never got the chance to ask her, because he never saw her again after she moved to the Southwest. The citizens of Walden did not travel for mere pleasure. Spur's grandparents had arrived on Walden penniless and with only a basic knowledge of farming. Yet hard work and brutal frugality had built their farmstead into a success. However, the price they paid for a single-minded dedication to farming was high. Of their 3 children, only Cape chose to stay on the farm as an adult. And even he moved out of Diligence Cottage when he was 16 and put up a hut for himself at the farthest edge of the Leung property. He was trying to escape their disapproval. Whenever he looked at the tell, or visited friends, or climbed a tree, or read a book, Jigo or Jiga would carpet him for being frivolous or lazy. They couldn't see the sense of volunteering for the fire department or playing left base for the Littleton Eagles when there were chores to be done. Sometimes weeks might pass without Cape saying an unnecessary word to his parents. Yet it had been Cape who transformed the family fortunes with his apples. When he was 18, he began attending classes at the Hortus School Extension in Long Walk, very much against Jugo's wishes. He had paid tuition out of money earned doing odd jobs around the village, another pointless diversion from home chores that irritated his parents. Cape had become interested in fruit trees, after brown rot spoiled almost the entire crop of Littleton sour cherries the year before. All the farmers in the village raised fruit, but their orchards were usually no more than a dozen trees, all of traditional heirloom varieties. Crops were small, usually just enough for home use because of the ravages of pests and disease. Farmers battled Terran immigrants, like tarnished plant bugs, sawflies, woolly aphids, coddling moths, leaf rollers, lesser apple worms, and the archenemy, Plum curculio. There were mildews, rusts, rots, cankers, blotches, and blights to contend with as well. The long growing season of fruit trees made them vulnerable to successive attacks. Citizens across the transcendent state debated whether or not Chairman Winter had introduced insect evil and fungal disease into his new Garden of Eden on purpose. The question had never been settled. But at Hortus School, Cape learned about neem spray, extracted from the chinaberry tree, and the organic insecticide pyrethrum, which was made from dried daisies. And he heard about an amazing cider apple called Wong's Nectar, a disease-resistant early bloomer well-suited to the climate of Southeast, but not yet proven hardy in the North. As much despite his father as to test the new variety, he had drained his savings and bought a dozen saplings on W4 semi-dwarfing rootstock. He started his own orchard on land he had cleared near his hut. 2 years later, he brought in his first, admittedly light, harvest, which nevertheless yielded the sweetest cider and smoothest applejack anyone in Littleton had ever tasted. Cape purchased a handscrew press in his 3rd year and switched from fermenting his cider in glass carboys to huge oak barrels by his 5th. and he bought more apple trees. He never seemed to have enough. McIntosh, Go Red, Jay's Pippin, Alamar Gold, Adam and Eve. Soon he began to grow rootstock and sell trees to other farmers. By the time Cape married Spur's mother, the Leungs were renting land from farmsteads on either side of their original holding. Jigo and Jiga lived long enough to see their son become the most prosperous farmer in Littleton. Jigo, however, never forgave himself for being wrong, or Cape for being right, about the apples. Cape had given Spur and Comfort his parents' house as a wedding present. Diligence Cottage had been empty ever since Jiga had died. Cape had long since transformed his own little hut into one of the grandest homes in Littleton. Spur had Sly drop him off just down Jane Powder Street from the cottage, hoping to avoid the big house and the inevitable interrogation by his father for as long as possible. After seeing Sly's dismay at the news of the High Gregory's visit, he was thinking he might try to keep the High Gregory's identity from Cape if he could. However, as Spur approached the front door, he spotted Cape's scooter parked by the barn, and then Cape himself, reaching from a ladder into the scaffold branches of one of Jigo's ancient macoon apples. He was thinning the fruit set. This was twice a surprise, first, because Cape usually avoided the house where he had grown up, and second, because he had been set against trying to rejuvenate the Leung's original orchard, arguing that it was a waste of Spur's time. In fact, the peaches and the plum tree had proved beyond saving. However, through drastic pruning, Spur had managed to bring three macoons and one sunset apple and a North Star cherry back into production again. "Dida!" Spur called out so he wouldn't startle his father. "It's me!"
"Prosper?"
Cape did not look down as he twisted an unripe apple free.
"You're here already? Something's wrong?"
He dropped the cull to the pack of goss dogs waiting below. A female leapt and caught the apple in midair in its long beak. It chomped twice and swallowed. Then it chased its scaly tail in delight, while the others hooted at Cape. "Everything's fine. There was a last-minute change, and I managed to get a ride home." Spur doubted his father would be satisfied with this vague explanation, but it was worth a try. "What are you doing up there?" He dropped his kit on the front step of the farmhouse and trudged over to the orchard.
"I thought you hated Jigo's useless old trees,"
Cape sniffed.
"Macoon is a decent enough apple. They're just too damn much work. And since you weren't around to tend to them... But I should come down. You're home, Prosper. Wait, I'll come down."
"No, finish what you're doing. How are things here?"
"It was a dry spring."
He culled another green apple, careful to grasp the fruiting spur with one hand and the fruit with the other.
"June was parched, too. But the county won't call it a drought yet."
The gossdog swirled and tumbled beneath him as he let the apple fall.
"The June drop was light, so I've had to do a lot of thinning. We had sawfly, but the curculio wasn't so bad. They let you out of the hospital so soon, Prosper. Tell me what you're not telling me."
"I'm fine. Ready to build fence and buck firewood."
"Have you seen Comfort yet?"
"No."
"You were supposed to ride by train."
"I hitched a ride with a friend."
"From Concord?"
"I got off the train in Wheelwright."
"Wheelwright?"
One of the goss dogs was trying to scrabble up the ladder.
"I don't know where that is exactly. Somewhere in southeast, I think. Lee County, maybe?"
"Around there." "What's wrong with macoons?"
"Ah," he shook his head in disapproval. "A foolish tree that doesn't know what's good for it."
He gestured at the immature apples all around him.
"Look at the size of this fruit set. Even after the June drop, there are too many apples left on the branches. Grow more than a few of these trees, and you'll spend the summer hand thinning. Have you seen Comfort yet?"
"I already said no." Spur plucked a low-hanging cherry, which held its green stem, indicating it wasn't quite ripe. Despite this, he popped it into his mouth. "Sour cherries aren't too far from harvest, I'd say." He spat the pit at the goss dogs. "They're pulling the entire regiment back to Cloyce Forest, which is where I'll catch up with them."
"Civic refreshment. You'll be busy."
Cape wound up and pitched a cull into the next row of trees.
As the pack hurtled after it, he backed down the ladder.
Although I wouldn't mind some help. You're home for how long?
Just the week. He hefted the ladder and pivoted it into the next tree.
Not much time.
No. He was about to climb up again when he realized that he had yet to greet his only son.
I'm glad you're safe, Prosper, he said,
placing a hand on his shoulder.
But I still don't understand about the train.
He held Spur at arm's length.
You got off why?
Spur was desperate to change the subject. Dita, I know you don't want to hear this, but Comfort and I are probably going to get divorced. Cape grimaced and let go of Spur.
Probably,
he set his foot on the bottom rung. Yes. The gossdogs are back already, swarming around the ladder, downy feathers flying.
I'm sorry.
Spur stepped away.
Prosper, you know my feelings about this.
He mounted the ladder.
But then everyone knows I'm a simple fool when it comes to keeping a woman.
Cape Leong had been saying things like that ever since Spur's mother had left him. On some days he bemoaned the failure of his marriage as a wound that had crippled him for life. On others he preened as if surviving it were his one true distinction. As a young man, Spur had thought these were merely poses and had resented his father for keeping his feelings about Spur's mother in a tangle. Now, Spur thought, maybe he understood.
Comfort was never comfortable here, Spur said morosely. I blame myself for that. But I don't think she was born to be a farmer's wife. Never was, never will be.
Are you sure?
Cape sucked air between his teeth as he leaned into the tree.
She's had a terrible shock, Prosper. Now this?
It isn't going to come as a shock, he said, his voice tight. His father had far too many reasons for wanting Spur to make his marriage work. He had always liked both of the Joe Early kids, and had loved the way Comfort had remade both Diligence Cottage and his only son. Cape was impatient for grandchildren, and then there was the matter of the land, once agreeably complicated, now horribly simple. Ever since they had been kid, it had been a running joke around the village that someday Spur would marry Comfort and unite the Joe Early farmstead with the Leung holdings, immediately adjacent to the east. Of course, everyone knew it wouldn't happen quite that way, because of Vic. But now, Vic was dead.
When will you see her?
I don't know, said Spur. Soon. Anyway, it's been a long day for me. I'm going in.
Come back to the house for supper, said Cape.
No, I'm too tired. I'll scrape up something to eat in the cottage.
You won't have to look too hard, he grinned. Your fans stopped by this morning to open the place up. I'm sure they left some goodies. I've been telling the neighbors that you were due home today.
He dropped another call to the gossdogs.
Now that I think about it, I should probably ride into town to tell folks not to meet your train. I still can't believe you got a ride all the way from... Where did you say it was again?
What fans?
I think it must have been Gandhi Joy who organized it. At least she was the one who came to the house to ask my permission.
He stepped off the ladder into the tree to reach the highest branches.
But I saw the Velez girls waiting in the van. Peace Toba, Summer Millisap.
He stretched for a particularly dense cluster of apples.
Oh, and after they left, I think Comfort might have stopped by the cottage.
Chapter 10. Chapter 10 begins with a quote from Walden. I find it wholesome to be alone the greater part of the time. To be in company, even with the best, is soon wearisome and dissipating.
The refrigerator was stocked with a chicken and parsnip casserole, a pot of barley soup, half a dozen eggs, a little tub of butter, a slab of goat cheese, and three bottles of root beer. There was a loaf of fresh onion bread and glass jars of homemade apricot and pear preserves on the counter. But what Spur ate for supper was pie. Someone had baked him two pies, a peach and an apple. He ate half of each and washed them down with root beer. Why not? There was nobody around to scold him, and he was too tired to heat up the soup or the casserole, much less to eat them. Eating pie took no effort at all. Besides, he hadn't had a decent slice of pie since he had left Littleton. The niceties of baking were beyond the field kitchens of the Corps of Firefighters. Afterward, he poured himself a tumbler of applejack and sat at the kitchen table, trying to decide who had brought what. The barley soup felt like an offering from sturdy Peace Toba. Gandy Joy knew that he had developed a secret weakness for root beer, despite growing up in a farmstead that lived and died by cider. The Millisaps had the largest herd of goats in town. He wasn't sure who had made the casserole, although he would have bet it wasn't the Velez sisters. Casseroles were too matronly for the Velezes. They were in their early 20s and single and a little wild, at least by Littleton's standards. They had to be, since they were searching for romance in a village of just over 600 souls. Everyone said that they would probably move to Long Walk someday, or even to Heart's Wall, which would probably break their parents' hearts. He was guessing that the pies had come from their kitchen. A well-made pie was as good as a love letter. But would the Velez sisters just assume he and Comfort were finally going to split? Comfort must have decided on her own, and was telling people in the village. Then Spur remembered that Sly had said he had heard something, and if Sly knew, then everyone knew. In a nosy village like Littleton, if a kid skinned his knee playing baseball, at least three moms fell out of trees waving bandages. Spur put the food away and washed the dishes, after which there was no reason to stay in the kitchen. But he lingered for a while, trying to avoid the memories which whispered to him from the other rooms of the cottage. He remembered his stern grandparents ghosting around the wood stove in their last years. He remembered boarding Diligence Cottage up after Jigo died, the lumpy furniture and the threadbare carpet receding into the gloom. And then he and Comfort pulling the boards down and rediscovering their new home. The newlyweds had moved almost all of Jigo and Jiga's things to the barn, where they moldered to this day. Spur and Comfort had dusted and cleaned and scraped and painted everything in the empty cottage. He remembered sitting on the floor with his back to the wall of the parlor, looking at the one lonely chair they owned. Comfort had cuddled beside him because she said that if there wasn't room for both of them on the chair, then neither would sit. He had kissed her then. There had been a lot of kissing in those days. In fact, Comfort had made love to him in every room of the cottage. It was her way of declaring ownership and of exorcising the disapproving spirits of the old folks. Now that she was about to pass out of his life, Spur thought that Comfort might have been too ferocious a lover for his tastes. Sometimes it was all he could do to stay with her in bed. Occasionally her passion alarmed him, although he would never have admitted this to himself while they were together. It would have been unmanly. But just before he had volunteered for the Corps, when things had already begun to go wrong, he had felt as if there was always another man standing next to them, watching. Not anyone real, but rather Comfort's idea of a lover. Spur knew by then he wasn't that man. He had just been a placeholder for whoever it was she was waiting for. Finally, he left the kitchen. The women who had opened Diligence Cottage had done their best, but there was no air to work with on this close July night. The rooms were stale and hot. He sat out on the porch until the needle bugs drove him inside. Then he propped a fan in either window of the bedroom and dumped his kit out onto the bedspread. What did he have to wear that was cool? He picked up a t-shirt, but then smelled the tang of smoke still clinging to it. He dropped it onto the bed and chuckled mirthlessly. He was home. He could put on his own clothes. He opened the dresser drawer and pulled out the shorts that Comfort had bought for his birthday and a gauzy blue shirt. The pants were loose and slid down his hips. He had lost weight in the firefight, and even more in the hospital. Too much heartbreak, not enough pie. Then, against his better judgment, he crossed the bedroom to Comfort's dresser and began to open drawers. He had never understood why she abandoned everything she owned when she left him. Did it mean she was planning to come back? Or that she was completely rejecting their life together? He didn't touch anything, just looked at her panties. Black and navy blue and gray. No pastels or patterns for his girl. Then the bald socks, sleeveless blouses, shirts with the arms folded behind them, heavy work pants, lightweight sweaters. And in the bottom drawer, the jade pajamas of black market material so sheer that it would slip from her body if he even thought about tugging at it. Not exactly something a farmer's wife would wear. Spur spoke aloud just to hear a voice. The dense silence of the cottage was making him edgy. At least, not this farmer's wife. Now that he was losing Comfort, Spur realized that the only person in his family was his father. It struck him that he had no memories of his father in the cottage. He could see Cape in the dining room of the big house, or the library, or dozing in front of the tell, alone, always alone. Spur had a bad moment then. He stepped into the bathroom and splashed some cold water on his face. He would have to remarry, or he would end up like his father. He tried to imagine kissing Belle Velez, slipping a hand under her blouse. But he couldn't.
"Knock, knock," a woman called from the parlor. "Your father claims you're back."
It was Gandy Joy. "Just a minute." Spur swiped at his dripping face with the hand towel. As he strode from the bedroom, the smile on his face was genuine. He was grateful to Gandy Joy for rescuing him from the silence and his dark mood. She was a small, round woman with flyaway hair that was 8 different shades of gray. She had big teeth and an easy smile. Her green sundress exposed the wrinkled skin of her wide shoulders and arms. Despite farm work, she was still fair as the flesh of an apple. Spur had been mothered by many of the women of Littleton as a boy, but Gandy Joy was the one who meant the most to him. He had to stoop over slightly to hug her.
"Prosper," she squeezed him so hard it took his breath away. "My lovely boy, you're safe."
"Thank you for opening the cottage," he said. "But how did you find everything?" She smelled like lilacs, and he realized she must have perfumed herself, just for him.
"Small house." She stepped back to take him in. "Not many places a thing can be."
He studied her as well. She seemed to have aged 5 years in the 10 months since he'd seen her last.
"Big enough,
especially for one."
"I'm sorry, Prosper."
When Spur saw the sadness shadow her face, he knew that she had heard something. She was, after all, the village virtuator. He supposed he should have been relieved that Comfort was letting everyone know she wanted a divorce, since that was what he wanted, too. Instead, he just felt hollow.
"What has she told you?"
Gandy Joy shook her head.
"You two have to talk."
He thought about pressing her, but decided to let it drop.
"Have a seat, Gandy. Can I get you anything? There's Applejack."
He steered her toward the sofa. "And root beer?"
"No, thanks."
She nodded at her wooden bead purse, which he now noticed against the bolster of the sofa.
"I brought communion."
"Really?" he said, feigning disappointment. "Then you're only here on business?
I'm here for more reasons than you'll ever know.
She gave him a playful tap on the arm.
And keeping souls in communion is my calling, lovely boy, not my business.
She settled on the sofa next to her purse, and he sat facing her on the oak chair that had once been his only stick of furniture.
How long are you with us?
She pulled out 3 incense burners and set them on the cherry wood table that Comfort had ordered all the way from Providence.
A week.
Spur had seen Gandy Joy's collection of incense burners, but he had never known her to use 3 at once for just 2 people.
Well, I'll catch up with the squad at Cloyce Forest. Easy work for a change. Just watching the trees grow.
He considered 3 excessive. After all, he had accepted communion regularly with the other firefighters.
We weren't expecting you so soon.
She slipped the aluminum case marked with the seal of the Transcendent State from her purse.
You didn't come on the train.
No.
She selected a communion square from the case. She touched it to her forehead, the tip of her nose, and her lips, and then placed it on the edge of the incense burner. She glanced up at him, and still the silence stretched.
Just know,
she said finally.
That's all?
Spur handed her the crock of matches kept especially for communion.
My father told you to ask that, didn't he?
I'm old, Prosper.
Her smile was crooked. I've earned the right to be curious. She repeated the ritual with the second communion square.
You have, but he really wants to know.
He always does.
She set the third communion in its burner.
But then everyone understands about that particular bend in capability, Saul.
She selected a match from the crock and struck it. Now it was Spur's turn to wait.
So, aren't you going to ask me about the train?
I was, but since you have something to hide, I won't.
She touched the fire to each of the 3 squares, and they caught immediately, the oils in the communion burning with an eager yellow flame.
I don't really care, Spur. I'm just happy you're back and safe.
She blew the flames out on each of the squares, leaving a glowing edge.
Make the most of your time with us.
Spur watched the communion smoke uncoil in the still air of his parlor. Then, as much to please Gandy Joy as to reestablish his connection with the village, he leaned forward and breathed deeply. The fumes that filled his nose were harsh at first, but wispier and so much sweeter than the strangling smoke of a burn. As he settled back into his chair, he got the subtle accents, the yeasty aroma of bread baking, a whiff of freshly split oak, and just a hint of the sunshine scent of a shirt fresh off the clothesline. He could feel the communion smoke fill his head and touch his soul.
It bound him, as always, to the precious land and the cottage where his family had made a new life,
the orderly Leung farmstead, his hometown, and of course to this woman, who loved him more than his mother ever had, and his flinty father, who couldn't help the way he was, and faithful sly Sawatdi, and generous Leif Benkelman, and droll Will Sambusa, and steadfast Peace Toba, and the entire Velez family, who had always been so generous to him, and yes, even to his dear Comfort Rose Jorley, who was leaving him, but who was nonetheless a virtuous citizen of Littleton. He shivered when he noticed Gandy Joy watching him. No doubt she was trying to gauge whether he had fully accepted communion.
Thank you, he said, for all the food.
She nodded, satisfied.
You're welcome. We just wanted to show how proud we are of you. This is your village, after all, and you're our Prosper, and we want you to stay with us always.
He chuckled nervously. Why did everyone think he was going somewhere? She leaned forward and lowered her voice.
But I have to say there was more than a little competition going on over the cooking.
She chuckled. Bets were placed on which dish you'd eat first.
Bets?
Spur found the idea of half a dozen women competing to please him quite agreeable. And what did you choose?
After I saw everything laid out, I was thinking you'd start in on pie. After all, there wasn't going to be anyone to tell you no.
Spur laughed. Pie was all I ate. But don't tell anyone. She tapped her forefinger to her lips and grinned.
So I'm guessing that the Velez girls made the pies?
There was just the one. An apple, I think, is what Belle said.
I found two on the counter, apple and a peach.
Really?
Gandhi sat back on the couch. Someone else must have dropped it off after we left.
Might have been comfort, said Spur. Dida said he thought she stopped by.
I was expecting to find a note.
Comfort was here?
She lives here, said Spur testily. At least, all her stuff is here. Gandhi took a deep breath over the incense burners and held it for several moments.
I'm worried about her, she said finally. She hasn't accepted communion since we heard about Vic. She keeps to herself, and when we go to visit her at home, she's as friendly as a brick. There's mourning, and then there's self-pity, Prosper. She's been talking about selling the farmstead, moving away. We've lost poor Victor. We don't want to lose her, too. Littleton wouldn't be the same without the Jorleys. When you see her, whatever you two decide, make sure she knows that.
Spur almost groaned then, but the communion had him in its benevolent grip. If citizens didn't help one another, there would be no transcendent state.
I'll do my best, he said, his voice tight.
Oh, I know you will, my lovely boy. I know it, in my soul.
Chapter 11. Chapter 11 begins with a quote from the Journal of 1850. Things do not change. We change. The High Gregory sat next to Spur in the bed of the Sawat D's truck, their backs against the cab, watching the dust billow behind them. Sly and Naganda rode up front. As the truck jolted down Blue Valley Road, Spur could not help but see the excitement on the High Gregory's face. The dirt track was certainly rough, but the boy was bouncing so high, Spur was worried that he'd fly over the side. He was even making Sly nervous, and the old farmer was usually as calm as moss. But then Sly Sawat D didn't make a habit of giving rides to upsiders. He kept glancing over his shoulder at the High Gregory through the open rear slider. Spur had no doubt that his cover story for the High Gregory in Naganda was about to unravel. The High Gregory had decided to wear purple overalls with about 20 brass buttons. Although there was nothing wrong with his black T-shirt, the bandana knotted around his neck was a pink disaster embellished with cartoons of beets and carrots and corn on the cob. At least he had used some upsider trick to disguise the color of his eyes. Naganda's clothes weren't quite as odd, but they too were a problem. Spur had seen citizens wearing flare jackets and high-collar shirts, but not on a hot summer Sunday and not in Littleton. Naganda was dressed for a meeting at the cooperative's Office of Diplomacy in Concord. Spur's only hope was to whisk them both to Diligence Cottage and either hide them there or find them something more appropriate to wear.
"Tell me about the Goss dogs," said the High Gregory.
Spur leaned closer, trying to hear him over the roar of the truck's engine, the clatter of its suspension, and the crunch of tires against the dirt road.
"Say again?" "The Goss dogs," shouted the High Gregory. "One of your native species, you know, four-footed, feathered. They run in packs."
"Goss dogs, yes. What do you want to know?"
"You eat them?"
"I don't."
The High Gregory seemed to be waiting for him to elaborate, but Spur wasn't sure what he wanted to know exactly.
"Other citizens do,
but the browns only. The other breeds are supposed to be too stringy.
And when you kill them, do they know they're about to die? How do you do it?
I don't.
Spur had never slaughtered a gossdog. Cape didn't believe in eating them. However, Spur had slaughtered chickens and goats, and helped once with a bull. Butchering was one of the unpleasant chores that needed doing on a farm, like digging post holes or mucking out the barn.
They don't suffer.
Really? That's good to know.
The High Gregory did not look convinced.
How smart do you think they are?
At that moment, Sly stepped on the brakes and swung the steering wheel. The truck bumped onto the smooth pavement of Civic Route 22.
Not very, said Spur, with the road noise abating, his voice carried into the cab. Not very what?
The High Gregory propped himself up to speak through the open window.
I was asking Spur how smart the gossdogs are. I couldn't find much about them, considering. Why is that, do you suppose?
The Com Explorer survey team rated them just 6.4 on the PK Animal Intelligence Scale, said Naganda. A goat has more brains.
Yes, I found that, said the High Gregory. But what's interesting is that the first evaluation was the only one ever done. And it would have been very much in the company's interest to test them low, right? And of course it made no sense for your puck-pucks to bother with a follow-up test. And now your transcendent state has a stake in keeping that rating as it is.
Are you suggesting some kind of conspiracy? Naganda was working his way to a fine outrage. That we're deliberately abusing an intelligent species?
I'm just asking questions, friend Constant. And no, I'm not saying they're as smart as humans. No, no, never. But suppose they were retested and their intelligence was found to be, let's say, 8.3, or even 8.1. The Thousand Worlds might want to see them protected.
Protected? The deputy's voice snapped through the window.
Why? Don't you think that would be a good idea? You just have to round them up and move them to a park or something. Let them loose in their native habitat.
There is no native habitat left on Walden. Spur noticed that Sly was so intent on the conversation that he was coasting down the highway. Except maybe underwater. A westbound oil truck was catching up to them fast.
We could build them one, said the High Gregory cheerfully. The Long could raise the money. They need something to do.
Can I ask you something?
Naganda had passed outrage and was well on his way to fury.
Yes, friend Constant. Of course.
How old are you?
12 standard. My birthday is next month. I don't want a big party this year. It's too much work.
They know themselves in the mirror, said Sly.
What?
Naganda was distracted from whatever point he was about to make.
What did you just say?
When one of them looks at his reflection, he recognizes himself.
Sly leaned back toward the window as he spoke.
We had this brood, a mother and three pups, who stayed indoors with us last winter. They were house-trained, mostly.
The truck slowed to a crawl.
So my granddaughter, Brookie, is playing dress-up with the pups one night, and the silly little pumpkin decides to paint one all over with grape juice. Said she was trying to make the first purple gossdog. Her father babies her, don't you know? But she actually stains the right rear leg before her mother catches her out. And when Brookie lets the poor thing loose, it galumps to the mirror and backs up to see its grapey leg. Then it gets to whimpering and clucking and turning circles like they do when they're upset.
Sly checked the rearview mirror and noticed the oil truck closing in on them for the first time.
I was there, saw it clear as tap water. The idea that it knew who it was tipped me over for a couple of days.
He put two wheels onto the shoulder of CR-22 and waved the truck past.
It's been a hardship, but I've never eaten a scrap of goss dog since.
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, said Naganda.
Lots of citizens feel that way.
As is their right. But to jump to conclusions based on this man's observations.
I don't want to jump, friend Constant, said the High Gregory. Let's not jump.
Although the deputy was ready to press his argument, no one else spoke, and gradually he subsided. Sly pulled back onto CR-22 and drove the rest of the way at a normal pace. They passed the rest of the trip in silence. The wind seemed to whip Spur's thoughts right out of his head. As they turned off Jane Powder Street onto the driveway of the cottage, Sly called back to him,
"Looks like you've got company."
Spur rubbed the back of his neck in frustration. Who told the townsfolk that he wanted them to come visiting? He leaned over the side of the truck, but couldn't see anyone until they parked next to the porch. Then he spotted the scooter, leaning against the barn. If it was really in the High Gregory's power to make luck, then what he was brewing up for Spur so far was pure misfortune. It was Comfort's scooter. The High Gregory stood up in the back of the truck and turned around once, surveying the farmstead.
"This is your home, Spur."
He said it not as a question, but as a statement, as if Spur were the one seeing it for the first time.
"I understand now why you would want to live so far from everything. It's like a poem here."
Constant Naganda opened the door and stepped down onto the dusty drive. From his expression, the deputy appeared to have formed a different opinion of the cottage. However, he was enough of a diplomat to keep it to himself. He clutched a holdall to his chest and was mounting the stairs to the porch when he noticed that no one had moved from the truck. They were watching Comfort stalk toward them from the barn, so clearly in a temper that heat seemed to shimmer off her in the morning swelter.
"That woman looks angry as lightning," said Sly. "You want me to try to get in the way?"
"No," said Spur. "She'd probably just knock you over."
"But this is your Comfort," said the High Gregory. "The wife that you don't live with anymore? Oh, this is so exciting. Just what I was hoping for. She's come for a visit. Maybe to welcome you back."
"I'm not expecting much of a welcome," said Spur. "If you'll excuse me, I should talk to her. Sly, if you wouldn't mind staying a few minutes, maybe you could take Constant and young Lucky here inside. There's plenty to eat."
"Lucky," said the High Gregory, repeating the name they had agreed on for him, as if reminding himself to get into character. "Hello, friend Comfort," he called. "I'm Lucky. Lucky Naganda."
She shook the greeting off and kept bearing down on them. His wife was a slight woman, with fine features and eyes dark as currants. Her hair was long and sleek and black. She was wearing a sleeveless yellow gingham dress that Spur had never seen before, part of her new wardrobe, he thought. Her new life. When he had been in love with her, Spur had thought that Comfort was pretty. But now, seeing her for the first time in months, he decided that she was merely delicate. She did not look strong enough for the rigors of life on a farm. Spur opened the tailgate, and the High Gregory jumped from the back of the truck. Naganda came back down the stairs to be introduced to Comfort. Spur was handing the High Gregory's bag down to Sly as she drew herself up in front of them.
"Candy Joy said you wanted to see me first thing in the morning."
She did not waste time on introductions. "I didn't realize I'd be interrupting a party." "Comfort," said Spur. "I'm sorry." He stopped himself then, chagrined at how easily he fell into the old pattern. When they were together, he was always apologizing.
"Morning, sweet corn," said Sly. "Not that much of a party, I'm afraid."
"But there are snacks inside," the High Gregory said. "This is such a beautiful place you two have. I've just met Spur myself, but I'm pretty sure he's going to be happy here someday. My name is Lucky Naganda." He held out his hand to her. "We're supposed to shake, but first you have to say your name."
Comfort had been so fixated on Spur that she had brushed by the High Gregory. Now she scrutinized him in all his purple glory, and her eyes went wide.
"Why are you dressed like that? Is something wrong?"
He glanced down at his overalls.
"I'm dressed to visit my friend Spur."
He patted his bare head.
"It's the hat, isn't it? I'm supposed to be wearing a hat."
"Constant Naganda, a friend of Spur's from the Ninth." Naganda oozed between them. "I apologize for intruding. I know you have some important things to discuss. Why don't we give you a chance to catch up now? My nephew and I will be glad to wait inside." He put an arm around the High Gregory's shoulder and aimed him at the porch.
Wait, said the High Gregory. I thought I was your cousin.
Take as long as you want, Spur, Naganda said as he hustled the boy off. We'll be fine. Sly shook his head in disbelief. I'll make sure they don't get into trouble. He started after them.
There are pies in the refrigerator, Spur called after him. Most of an apple pie and just a couple of slices of a peach.
He steeled himself and turned back to comfort. My father said you were here the other day. He aimed a smile at her, but it bounced off. You made my favorite pie.
Who are those people?
Her eyes glittered with suspicion.
The boy is strange. Why have you brought them here?
Let's walk. He took her arm and was surprised when she went along without protest. He felt the heat of her glare cooling as they strode away from the cottage. I did have a chat with Gandhi Joy, he said. She said you were feeling pretty low.
I have the right to feel however I feel, she said stiffly.
You haven't been accepting communion.
Communion is what they give you so you feel smart about acting stupid. Tell her I don't need some busybody blowing smoke in my eyes to keep me from seeing what's wrong.
She stopped and pulled him around to face her.
We're getting divorced, Spur.
Yes, he held her gaze. I know. He wanted to hug her, or maybe shake her, touch her long black hair. Instead, his hands hung uselessly by his sides. But I'm still concerned about you.
Why?
You've been talking about moving away? She turned and started walking again.
I can't run the farm by myself.
We could help you, Dida and I. He caught up with her.
Hire some of the local kids. Maybe bring in a tenant from another village. And how long do you think that would work for? If you want to run my farm, Spur, buy it from me.
Your family is an important part of this place. The whole village wants you to stay. Everyone would pitch in. She chuckled grimly.
Everyone wanted us to get married. They want us to stay together. I'm tired of having everyone in my life.
He wasn't going to admit to her that he felt the same way sometimes. Where will you go?
Away.
Just away?
I miss him. I really do. But I don't want to live anywhere near Vic's grave.
Spur kicked a stone across the driveway and said nothing for several minutes. You sure it's not me you want to get away from?
No, Spur. That's one thing I am sure of.
When did you decide all this?
Spur, I'm not mad at you.
Impulsively, she went up on tiptoes and aimed a kiss at the side of his face. She got mostly air, but their cheeks brushed, her skin hot against his.
I like you, especially when you're like this, so calm and thoughtful. You're the best of this lot, and you've always been sweet to me. It's just that I can't live like this anymore.
I like you too, Comfort. Last night, after I accepted communion...
Enough. We like each other. We should stop there. It's a good place to be.
She bumped up against him.
Now tell me about that boy. He isn't an upsider, is he?
She shot him a challenging look, and he tried to bear up under the pressure of her regard. They walked in silence while he decided what he could say about Naganda and the High Gregory.
Can you keep a secret?
She sighed.
You know you're going to tell me, so get to it.
They had completely circled the cottage. Spur spotted the High Gregory watching them from a window. He turned Comfort toward the barn. 2 days ago, when I was still in the hospital, I started sending greetings to the upside. He waved off her objections. Don't ask. I don't know why exactly, other than that I was bored. Anyway, the boy answered one of them. He's the High Gregory of the Laung. Phosphorescence of something or other, I forget what. He's from Kenning in the Theta Persei system, and I'm guessing he's pretty important, because the next thing I knew, he QIC'd himself to Walden and had me pulled off a train. He told her about the Hover and Memson and the kids of the Laung
and how he was being forced to show the High Gregory his village. Oh, and he supposedly makes luck.
What does that mean? Said Comfort. How does somebody make luck?
I don't know exactly, but Memson and the Laung are all convinced that he does it, whatever it is. They had wandered into Jiga's flower garden. Comfort had tried to make it her own after they had moved in. However, she had had neither the time nor the patience to tend persnickety plants, and so grew only daylilies and hostas and rugose roses. After a season of neglect, even these tough flowers were losing ground to the bindweed and quackgrass and spurge. Spur sat on the fieldstone bench that his grandfather had built for his grandmother. He tapped on the seat for her to join him. She hesitated, then settled at the far end, twisting to face him.
He acts too stupid to be anyone important, she said. What about that slip he made about being the cousin and not the nephew? Are the people on his world idiots?
Maybe he intended to say it. Spur leaned forward and pulled a flat clump of spurge from the garden. After all, he's wearing those purple overalls. He's really not trying very hard to pretend he's a citizen. He knocked the dirt off the roots and left it to shrivel in the sun. What if he wanted me to tell you who he was and decided to make it happen? I think he's used to getting his way.
So what did he want with us?
Her expression was unreadable.
I'm not sure. I think what Memson was telling me is that he has come here to see how his being here changes us.
He shook his head.
Does that make any sense? It doesn't have to, she said. He's from the upside. They don't think the same way we do.
Maybe so. It was a commonplace that had been drilled into them in every self-reliance class they had ever sat through. It was, after all, the reason that Chairman Winter had founded Walden. But now that he had actually met upsiders, Memson and the High Gregory and the Laung, he wasn't sure that their ways were so strange. But this wasn't the time to argue the point.
Look, Comfort, I have my own reason for telling you all this, he said. I need help with him. At first I thought he was just going to pretend to be one of us and take a quiet look at the village. Now I'm thinking he wants to be discovered so he can make things happen. So I'm going to try to keep him busy here if I can. It's just for one day. He said he'd leave in the morning. And you believe that?
I'd like to. He dug at the base of a dandelion with his fingers and pried it out of the ground with the long taproot intact. What other choice do I have? He glanced back at the cottage, but couldn't see the High Gregory in the window anymore. We'd better get back. She put a hand on his arm.
First, we have to talk about Vic.
Spur paused, considering. We can do that if you want. He studied the dandelion root as if it held the answers to all his problems. We probably should. But it's hard, Comfort. When I was in the hospital, the upsiders did something to me. A kind of treatment that... She squeezed his arm and then let go.
There's just one thing I have to know. You were with him at the end. At least, that's what we heard. You reported his death.
It was quick, said Spur. He didn't suffer. This was a lie he had been preparing to tell her ever since he had woken up in the hospital.
That's good. I'm glad. She swallowed. Thank you. But did he say anything? At the end, I mean?
Say? Say what?
You have to understand that after I moved back home, I found that Vic had changed. I was shocked when he volunteered for the Corps, because he was actually thinking of leaving Littleton. Maybe Walden, too. He talked a lot about going to the upside.
She clutched her arms to her chest so tightly that she seemed to shrink.
He didn't believe. You can't tell anyone about this. Promise?
Spur shut his eyes and nodded. He knew what she was going to say.
How could he not?
Nevertheless, he dreaded hearing it. Her voice shrank as well.
He had sympathy for the Puk Puks. Not for the burning, But he used to say that we didn't need to cover every last scrap of Walden with forest. He talked about respecting.
Without warning, the nightmare leapt from a darkness in his soul like some ravening predator. It chased him through a stand of pine. Trees exploded like firecrackers. Sparks bit through his sibbies and stung him. He could smell burning hair. His hair. But he didn't want to smell his hair burning.
Spur was trying desperately to get back to the bench in the garden, back to comfort. But she kept pushing him deeper into the nightmare. After we heard he'd been killed, I went to his room.
He beckoned, and for a moment Spur thought it might not be Vic at all. As the anguished face shimmered in the heat of the burn, Vic wouldn't betray them, would he?
It was in his handwriting.
Spur had to dance to keep his shoes from catching fire, and he had no escape, no choice, no time. The torch spread his arms wide, and Spur stumbled into his embrace, and with an angry whoosh, they exploded together into flame. Spur felt his skin crackle,
and he screamed.
Chapter 12. Chapter 12 begins with a quote from A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers. We are paid for our suspicions by finding what we suspected. Everyone said that he had nothing to be embarrassed about, but Spur was nonetheless deeply ashamed. He had been revealed as unmanly, weak, and out of control. He had no memory of how he had come to be laid out on the couch in his own parlor. He couldn't remember if he had wept, or cursed, or just fainted and been dragged like a sack of onions across the yard into the cottage. When he emerged from the nightmare, all he knew was that his throat was raw and his cheeks were hot. The others were all gathered around him, trying not to look worried, but not doing a very convincing job of it. He wasn't sure which he minded more. That the strangers had witnessed his breakdown, or that his friends and neighbors had. When he sat up, a general alarm rippled through the onlookers. When he tried to stand, Sly pressed him back onto the couch with a firm grip on the shoulder. Comfort fetched him a glass of water. She was so distraught that her hand shook as she offered it to him. He took a sip, more to satisfy the others than to quench his own thirst. They needed to think they were helping, even though the best thing they could have done for him then, go away and leave him alone, was the one thing they were certain not to do. Maybe I should call Dr. Niss. Spur's laugh was as light as ashes. As for my money back.
You're right!
Constant Naganda lit up at the thought, then realized that his enthusiasm was unseemly.
I mean, shouldn't we notify the hospital? He said, eyeing the tell on the parlor wall. They may have concerns.
Spur knew that the deputy would love to have him whisked away from Littleton in the hopes that the High Gregory and the Leung would follow. He wondered briefly if that might not be for the best. But then he had been humiliated enough that morning. There's nothing to worry about.
Good, said Naganda. I'm happy to hear that, Spur. Do you mind? I promised to check in with the cooperative when we arrived.
Without waiting for a reply, Naganda bustled across the parlor to the kitchen. Meanwhile, the High Gregory had sprawled onto a chair, his legs dangling over the armrest. He was flipping impatiently through a back issue of Didactic Arts True History Comics, without really looking at the pages. Spur thought he looked even more squirmy than usual, as if he knew there was someplace else he was supposed to be. Sly Sawat D had parked himself next to Spur. His hands were folded in his lap, his eyelids were heavy, and he hummed to himself from time to time, probably thinking about fishing holes and berry patches and molasses cookies.
I'm so sorry, Spur, said Comfort. I just didn't realize.
It was the third time she had apologized. She wasn't used to apologizing, and she didn't do it very well. Meanwhile, her anguish was smothering him. Her face was pale, her mouth was as crooked as a scar. What had he said to her? He couldn't remember, but it must have been awful. There was a quiet desperation in her eyes that he had never seen before. It scared him. Spur set the glass of water on the end table.
Listen, Comfort, there's nothing for you to be sorry about. He was the one who had fallen apart, after all. Let's just forget it, all right? I'm fine now. To prove it, he stood up. Sly twitched, but did not move to pull him back onto the couch again.
Have enough air up there, my hasty little sparrow?
I'm fine, he repeated, and it was true. Time to put this by and move on. Change the subject.
Who wants to see the orchard?
Lucky?
If you don't mind, said Sly, my bones are in no mood for a hike, but I'll make us lunch.
I'll come, said Naganda.
Comfort looked as if she wanted to beg off, but guilt got the better of her. They tramped around the grounds, talking mostly of farm matters. After they had admired the revived orchard, inspected the weed-choked garden, toured the barn, played with a pack of goss dogs that wandered over from the big house and began to follow them everywhere, walked the boundaries of the cornfield, which Cape had planted in clover, until Spur was ready to farm again. They hiked through the woods, down to Mercy's Creek. We take some irrigation water from the creek, but the Jorleys own the rights, so there's water in our end of the creek pretty much all year long. Spur pointed. There's a pool in the woods where Comfort and I used to swim when we were kids. It might be a good place to cool off this afternoon.
And so you and Spur were neighbors?
The High Gregory had been trying to draw Comfort out all morning, without much success.
You grew up together like me and my friends. I was hoping to bring them along, but Uncle Constant Naganda said there were too many of them. Your family is still living on the farm?
Mom died. She left everything to us. Now, Vic's dead.
Yes, Spur said that your brother was a brave firefighter. I know that you are very sad about it, but I see much more luck ahead for you.
She leaned against a tree and stared up at the sky. There used to be a puck-puck town in these woods. Spur was itching to move on. They built all along the creek. It's overgrown now, but we could go look at the ruins. The High Gregory stepped off the bank onto a flat stone that stuck out of the creek.
And your father?
He left, said Comfort dully. When they were little, Spur said quickly. He knew that Comfort did not even like to think about her father, much less talk about him with strangers. Park Nen had married into the Jorley family. Not only was his marriage to Rosie Jorley stormy, but he was also a loner who had never adjusted to village ways. The last we heard, Park was living in Freeport. The High Gregory picked his way across the creek on stepping stones.
He was a puck-puck, no?
His foot slipped, and he windmilled his arm to keep his balance.
Who told you that?
If Comfort had been absent-minded before, she was very much present now.
I forget.
He crossed back over the stream in four quick hops.
Was it you, Uncle?
Naganda licked his lips nervously.
I've never heard of this person.
Then maybe it was Spur.
Spur would have denied it if Comfort had given him the chance.
He never knew.
Her voice was sharp.
Nobody did.
She confronted the boy.
Don't play games with me, upsider.
He tried to back away, but she pursued him.
Why do you care about my father? Why are you here?
Are you crazy?
Naganda caught the High Gregory as he stumbled over a rock, and then thrust the boy behind him.
This is my nephew, Lucky.
She knows, friend Constant.
The High Gregory peeked out from behind the deputy's flare jacket. He was glowing with excitement.
Spur told her everything.
Oh, no. This isn't going well at all.
Memsit gave us all research topics for the trip here to meet Spur, said the High Gregory. Kai Thousandfold was assigned to find out about you. You'd like him. He's from Bellwether. He says that he's very worried about you, friend Comfort.
Tell him to mind his own business.
Spur was aghast. Comfort, I'm sorry. I didn't know.
Be quiet, Spur. These upsiders are playing you for the fool that you are.
Her eyes were wet.
I hardly knew my father, and what I did know, I didn't like. Mom would probably still be alive if she hadn't been left to manage the farm by herself all those years.
Her chin quivered. Spur had never seen her so agitated.
She told us that Grandma Nen was a puck-puck, but that she emigrated from the Barrens long before my father was born, and that he was brought up a citizen like anyone else.
Tears streaked her face.
So don't you think you understand anything about me because you found out about a dead woman who I never met?
With that, she turned and walked stiff-legged back toward Diligent's cottage. She seemed to have shrunk since the morning, and now looked so insubstantial to Spur that a summer breeze might carry her off like milkweed. He knew there was more, much more, they had to talk about, but first they would have to find a new way to speak to each other. As she disappeared into the woods, he felt a twinge of nostalgia for the lost simplicity of their youth, when life really had been as easy as Chairman Winter promised it could be.
I'm hungry. The High Gregory seemed quite pleased with himself. Is it lunchtime yet?
After he had spun out lunch for as long as he could, Spur was at a loss as to how to keep the High Gregory out of trouble. They had exhausted the sights of the Leung farmstead, short of going over to visit with his father in the big house. Spur considered it, but decided to save it for a last resort. He had hoped to spend the afternoon touring the Jorley farmstead, but now that was out of the question. As the High Gregory fidgeted about the cottage, picking things up and putting them down again, asking about family pics, opening cabinets, and pulling out drawers, Spur proposed that they take a spin around Littleton in Sly's truck. A rolling tour, he told himself. No stops. The strategy worked for most of an hour. At first, the High Gregory was content to sit next to Spur in the back of the truck as he pointed out Littleton's landmarks and described the history of the village. They drove up Lamana Ridge Road to look over Point, from which they had a view of most of Littleton Commons. The village had been a third-wave settlement, populated by the winners of the lottery of 2432. In the first years of the settlement, the 25 founding families had worked together to construct the buildings of the Commons, the Self-Reliance School, Athenaeum, Communion Lodge, Town Hall, and Littleton's First Exchange, where goods and services could be bought or bartered. The first 25 had lived communally in rough barracks until the buildings on the Commons were completed, and then gradually moved out to their farmsteads as land was cleared and crews of carpenters put up the cottages and barns and sheds for each of the families. The Leungs had arrived in the second 25, 4 years afterward. The railroad had come through 3 years after that, and most of the businesses of the First Exchange moved from the Commons out to Shedtown by the train station. Sly drove them down the ridge, and they bumped along back roads, past farms and fields and pastures. They viewed the Toba and Perrochet and Velez farmsteads from a safe distance, and past Sambusa's lumberyard at the confluence of Mercy's Creek and the Swift River. Then they pulled back onto CR 22. The only way back to Diligent's cottage was through the Commons. "Drive by the barracks," Spur called to Sly in the cab. "We can stretch our legs there," he said to the High Gregory. "I'll show you how the first 25 lived." One of the original barracks had been preserved as a historical museum across the lawn from the Communion Lodge. It was left open to any who wanted to view its dusty exhibits. Spur thought it the best possible choice for a stop. Except for Founder's Day, the chairman's birthday, and Thanksgiving, nobody ever went there. The Commons appeared to be deserted as they passed the buildings of the First Exchange. These had been renovated into housing for those citizens of Littleton who didn't farm, like the teachers at the Self-Reliance School, and Dr. Christopoulos, and some of the elders like Gandhi Joy. They saw Dahl Groth coming out of the Athenaeum. Recognizing the truck, she gave Sly a neighborly wave, but when she spotted Spur in the back, she smiled and began to clap, raising her hands over her head. This so pleased the High Gregory that he stood up and started clapping back at her. Spur had to brace him to keep him from pitching over the side of the truck.
But Dahl was the only person they saw. Spur couldn't believe his good fortune as they pulled up to the barracks, dust from the gravel parking lot swirling around them. The wind had picked up, but provided no relief from the midsummer's heat. Spur's shirt stuck to his back where he had been leaning against the cab of the truck. Although he wasn't quite sure whether the High Gregory could sweat or not, the boy's face was certainly flushed. Naganda looked as if he were liquefying inside his flare jacket. The weather fit Spur's latest plan neatly. He was hoping that after they had spent a half hour in the hot and airless barracks, he might be able to persuade the High Gregory to return to Diligence Cottage for a swim in the creek. After that, it would practically be supper time. And after that, they could watch the tell. Or he might teach the High Gregory some of the local card games. Spur had always been lucky at fool-all. It wasn't until the engine of the Sawat D's truck coughed and rattled and finally cut out that Spur first heard the whoop of the crowd. Something was going on at the ball fields next to the Self-Reliance School, just down the hill, a couple of hundred meters. He tried to usher the High Gregory into the barracks, but it was too late. Spur thought there must be a lot of people down there. They were making a racket that was hard to miss. The High Gregory cocked his head in the direction of the school and smiled.
"Lucky us," he said. "We're just in time for Memson."
That's the end of part 3. One more part to go.